Hearst Ranch is a proud sponsor of the Heritage Radio Network. Learn more about Hearst Ranch at HearstRanch.com.
This is Gastronomica, a Heritage Radio Network podcast. I'm your host for today, Jacqueline Rowell. This episode is produced in collaboration with Gastronomica, the Journal for Food Studies. This week, we return for What to Read Now, Spring 2022, which is dedicated to highlighting new books in food studies. Our newest issue is now available online. Our review section covers several new books and films in food, including Peach State by Adrian Sue, published by University of Pittsburgh Press in 2021. This book of poetry on food, cooking, and migration explores culinary experiences of Chinese Americans in the U.S. South. Amber Waves, the extraordinary biography of wheat, from wild grass to world megacrop, by Catherine Zabinski, a scholar of plant and soil ecology, explores one of the world's most ubiquitously cultivated crops. It was published by the University of Chicago Press in 2020. And Fat, a graphic novel and memoir by artist and writer Regina Hoffer, translated into English by Natasha Hoffmeyer, puts the author's experience of eating disorders into visceral and visual form through black and white drawings. It was published by Pennsylvania State University Press in 2021 through the Graphic Mundi imprint, a graphic series of nonfiction works that are dedicated to pressing topics in areas such as health, environment, science, and technology. To learn more about these recent books and others, check out our review section in Gastronomica's most recent issue, Spring 2022, now available online. I am joined today by Michael Klassens, assistant professor in the School of the Environment at the University of Toronto, president of CAFS, the Canadian Association for Food Studies, and author of the recently published book, From Dismal Swamp to Smiling Farms, Food, Agriculture, and Change in the Holland Marsh, just released in November 2021 by UBC Press. Michael, thank you for joining us and welcome to the show. Now, Michael, what are you reading these days?
Thanks for having me. Very happy to be here. I have a few books that I'll mention that, I've read, but I'm in the process of sort of combing back through because I think that they're so powerful. So the first is Max LeBaron's book, Pollution is Colonialism. Max is a Métis scholar at Memorial University. Just a sort of paradigm shifting book, I think. Three others really quickly. There's this book, Black Food Geographies by Ashante Reese. I think is also just a really, really important book. It's about race, self-reliance, sort of community self-reliance, and food access in Washington. And a kind of companion to that in some ways is Monica M. White's book, Freedom Farmers. Professor White sort of narrates kind of the founding of Tuskegee University talks about the ways in which sort of Black liberation was sort of tied up in the processes of kind of agricultural production. And then a final book that was originally released in 2011, but there's a new edition coming out this summer or this spring it links very nicely with Monica M. White's book, Freedom Farmers. So there's this book called Fields of Learning, The Student Farm Movement in North America by Frederick Kirschenman, Laura Sayer, and Sean Clark. And so, I'm interested in this book in particular because my own sort of research interests have been kind of ported over to campus farms. And so this book talks about, the kind of intersection of sort of food movements and campus sort of student focused food, movements. And so, I'm very interested and I'm very eager to read this new edition of this book, Fields of Learning, which again is coming out later on this spring.
Thanks, Michael. I'm going to keep an eye out for it. One of the things that struck me about all the books that you shared with us, all of them very much explore the issue of food politics, food change, within food systems and specifically related to the environment. And so this brings us to your book, which we're here to talk about today, From Dismal Swamp to Smiling Farms. So before we dig into the book itself, can you tell us more about what you do and your background in food and environmental studies?
Yeah, sure. So as you mentioned, I work at University of Toronto in the School of the Environment. And so my work, you know, I usually talk about it as being broadly framed within the context of social and ecological justice with an empirical focus within the context of the food system. So, you know, most of my work is focused on the food system and, you know, generally sort of urban and peri-urban sort of food systems, you know, relocalization of food systems and movements based around food systems. So I've done lots of work with sort of nonprofit organizations and community groups. And again, the last couple of years, I've been doing a lot of work on sort of student food movements. A lot of people have observed, of course, that, even going back to the civil rights movement, the anti-apartheid movement, the original organics movement, these were all sort of fomented to some extent on campuses. And of course, there's still lots of work to be done within the context of racial justice, et cetera. But, these sort of community campus partnerships were really able to kind of, make some significant headway, I think, in movements for social and also environmental justice. So, I see a lot of potential, a lot of promise in working with students on these issues and inspired by, a lot of the work that students across North America are doing within the context of sort of food systems transformation.
And so your research really brings together, or your work really brings together, teaching, research, and advocacy for food system change. Yeah. Is that new? Is that new, or did that come out of the work on your book?
Yeah, so I mean, it did emerge, I guess, from the work on the book. Partly in thinking about, just these kind of cascading crises, right, that we're facing. And thinking about, how do we actually address these in kind of sustainable ways and ways that will actually, make an impact. And so, again, this is what sort of drew my attention to working with students and also this kind of pedagogical piece. Lots of people have observed that, we probably have a lot of the kind of scientific understanding, the technical understanding that we need to sort of fundamentally transform the world and to make the kinds of interventions we need to make to significantly reduce carbon, to sort of climate change adaptation, mitigation, etc. But what seems to be missing, of course, is the popular and political will to some extent. And so I see pedagogy within this context as a process of kind of knowledge co-production, knowledge mobilization, these kinds of things. So this is where my interest in sort of food studies and pedagogy and food movement sort of intersect, I think.
And so the book is a case study of human-environmental relations, which is really focused on the Holland Marsh, which you describe as a 3,000-hectare protected agricultural area located just north of Toronto's suburbs. So you describe it as culture's marsh because the land itself was forged by humans out of wetland one century ago. And it's now a small but mightily productive agricultural area. So this is the kind of ground the space that's grounding your research. What brought you to the study of this particular region?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it was, I think as research projects often do start, mine was, it was just quite sort of serendipitous. The first year, so I did my PhD at York University. And in the first year, I sort of joined a local tour of kind of various kinds of food systems assets, if I can use that word, kind of around the greater Toronto area. And one of the places we stopped into was the Holland Marsh. And of course, as I mentioned in the book, I mean, if you grew up in this part of the world, which I did, to get north of the city, to get north of this like large urban agglomeration of Toronto, there's really only one way out, and that's Highway 400, which bisects the marsh. It goes right through the Holland Marsh. And so I had driven, down this Highway 400, so many times as a kid, going north to go camping or something. and, you know, never really thought sort of twice about it, you know? And then it wasn't until, yeah, this trip during the first year of my PhD where I was like, huh, this is kind of an interesting place. I want to, you know, I want to learn more about it. And it was framed within that tour that we took as a, you know, as a, as a kind of exemplar, you know, of local food production. And so, you know, again, it sort of piqued my interest and I wanted to sort of learn more about it. And, you know, as I dug into it, of course, and kind of tried to problematize it a little bit, I found out that it wasn't kind of, you know, as unproblematic as it was presented to us, I think, in the first instance.
And your description actually really resonated with me. I grew up in the area too, and I remember those drives up Highway 400 as well, and that transition that you described. So how many farms are there now? Can you give us a sense of the scale and the, you know, the industry that it supports?
Yeah, sure. So there are, so the whole area is about 7,400 hectares. And about 60% of that was drained for agricultural land, and about 40% of it is now sort of preserved wetland, marshland. And so, you know, there's about 7,400 acres that are actively cultivated, and there's about 125 farms in that area. So, you know, these farms are quite small compared to like what we think of in the context of, say, large scale industrialized agriculture. You know, for wheat production or corn or soy, where, you know, it's many thousands of acres. So yeah, the farms in the Hollow Marsh are relatively small. And you know, it's tough to get a good sort of reading on the kind of economic impact, but at least one study from the Hollow Marsh Growers Association estimated that the kind of total economic impact of the marsh in the local area. So this is not only the vegetables that are being grown, but also the packaging and processing and transportation activities is worth about $1 billion a year. You know, about $130 million in carrot production and $160 million in onion production. And those are really the main crops that are grown there. The average per hectare farm receipts are about four times higher than the provincial average. So what they grow on the marsh is very different than, you know, what you might see in, you know, sort of southwestern Ontario, where it is more kind of industrial, you know, soybeans, corn, tobacco to a lesser extent, these kinds of things. In the marsh, it's mostly, you know, carrots, onions, and celery. Those are the, you know, that makes up probably probably about 70% of the crops grown there. And then, you know, there's also some lettuce and, you know, some beets and, you know, to a lesser extent, but those three crops really dominate the area.
The market.
Yeah.
So that makes it some of the most profitable land, really, not only in Canada, but on the continent in terms of agricultural production.
Yeah, it does. Yeah, exactly.
So the book covers a wide time period, and you really focus on the last century, and I want to dig into that in a minute, but how far back do you reach and why?
Yeah, so I start, you know, in sort of time immemorial, I think, as I put it. So about, you know, maybe 14,000 years ago. And, you know, part of the reason why I do this is because, you know, one of the things I want to try to do with this book is demonstrate the ways that sort of capital is opportunistic. That's sort of, you know, a key theme of the book. And in order to do that, I wanted to kind of look at the kind of capital and nature of the area, right? How was this landscape assembled that would then sort of allow capital to sort of penetrate it in various kinds of ways? And you know, to talk about the marsh, you have to talk about the geology, right, and the kind of history of the area, because the kind of distinctive feature about the marsh is, of course, its soil. This organic order of soils, it's called in Canada, otherwise known as muck soil. And it's very different than, you know, conventional soil that you would see, you know, in the Highland areas or, you know, really anywhere else in the country or the continent. You know, there are pockets.
Wait, When you say conventional soil, do you mean mineral soil?
That's right.
Okay.
Yeah, like mixed mineral soil, loam, you know, clay mix, these kinds of things. Mm-hmm. The muck soil is, so if you've ever been near a wetland, and you can imagine plunging your hand into the wetland and just grabbing a handful of material, you know, if you haven't done this yet, next time you're around a marsh, try it. Mm-hmm. It's actually quite, you know, viscerally sort of appealing to just plunge your hand into these soft mucky areas. And what you would pull out is a kind of amalgam of, you know, there would be some moss in there. There would be, of course, lots of root matter. There'd be, you know, leaves probably sort of decomposed. There'd be a fine sort of black smeary silt. And that's, you know, that turns out to be a very, very productive growing media. And so the formation of that swamp in the first instance is predicated on the kind of geological history of the area, right? Because the Canadian Shield, of course, is just north of the Hollow Marsh. It's just north of that area, right? Just north of kind of Lake Simcoe. But below that, there was much softer rock. And so as glaciers sort of scoured this, you know, this part of the world over millennia, it dug out these sort of low-lying areas. And then eventually, you know, when things start to warm up about 14,000 years ago, water fills in these areas, little bits of plant material begin to grow and die off and grow and die off. And this is how you get, you know, plutification is the name. It's this sort of spreading out of wetlands, right? This is how sort of wetlands grow. And again, that is essential to understanding this muck soil and why this area in particular was targeted. So that's the kind of long-winded way of saying why I wanted to sort of explore that kind of geological history, because again, that sets the foundation through which capital can then find opportunities to sort of exploit that kind of so-called natural capital.
And the marsh is on the traditional lands of the Wendat and the Haudenosaunee and the Anishinaabeg. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right.
And so can you talk about some of the transformations that happened to produce out of a wetland, a farmland, the key transformations and the key moments of transformation?
Yeah, sure. So, as you say, you know, about sort of, well, 14,000 years ago, this land was under the stewardship of the Wendat. They're eventually over time displaced by the Haudenosaunee. And then after that, the Anishinaabe control this territory. There's sort of three main treaties, I guess, that are kind of germane to the area. So the Toronto Purchase, Treaty 13 in 1805. In 1818, there's the Nottawasaga Purchase, or Treaty 18. And then in 1923, the Williams Treaty was signed. And so the marsh is sort of, you know, it's sort of trisected by each of these, you know, parts of it are sort of subject to these different sort of treaty areas. But of course, you know, indigenous people are eventually sort of displaced from the area. And of course, they had used it for, as a source of food and sustenance for, you know, time immemorial. And, you know, the Carrying Place Trail ends just before the marsh. And, you know, so there's stories about how, you know, the marsh was, yeah, hunting grounds and, you know, it's a source of water, I mean, et cetera, et cetera. Again, eventually those are displaced. And as early as the kind of, you know, very late kind of 1800s, very early 1900s, people start talking about, the kind of agricultural potential of this area. Initially, I mean, it's written off, right? I mean, Dismal Swamp. I mean, this is what it was called by the kind of earliest sort of, you know, colonial explorers to sort of go through the marsh. They sort of wrote it off and called it a Dismal Swamp, and it was a wasteland. And there was also some fear, right, of wetlands at the time, right? There was a kind of, you know, people thought you could get cholera, all these kinds of things. Eventually, that narrative flips. Partly because of this kind of colonial kind of agricultural expansionist mindset and the notion that, you know, there was something inherently good about transforming landscapes, right? You had to make them productive. And so you could sort of purge these landscapes of their sort of ills and dangers through their transformation and, you know, by bringing them into kind of active, you know, production. And so, you know, there were sort of various kind of false starts, but by the, you know, by the 1920s, activity to sort of drain, you know, the Holland Marsh were sort of up and running. And and so, you know, the plan was basically to cut this, you know, I say in the book that it looks roughly kind of like a banana shape if you look at it from, you know, from a high enough vantage point. But essentially there was just a canal dug around, the wetland, and then, you know, the water was drained out, and that was that took a few years because, you know, you can imagine this is very tricky work, particularly in the 1920s, but, that's essentially what happened.
And your book, you include images to show, the physical manifestations of the land and the how it was carved out into different patches and as the farmland was created. And so you draw on a number of different kind of sources and methods that you bring together in a really interesting way within the book. Can you say, and then we're going to go to break, but can you say a little bit more about the materials that you looked at and how you connected the historical, the social, and environmental threads to tell this bigger story about political ecology and change?
So I mean, it's tricky, right? And you know, I quote, I think in the proof in the preface, William Cronin, who of course is a very, you know, maybe the environmental historian, right? And he talks about, assembling a kind of a story, right? He thinks of history as kind of assembling a story, and that, you know, you tell stories through your own particular understandings of the world, right? There isn't just kind of one, one kind of definitive history of kind of how things unfolded. So I really took that to heart in my own approach. And so what I tried to do is kind of triangulate, you know, from lots of different sources. So of course I spent a lot of time in and around the Holland Marsh. Many of the farmers there, you know, I rode on tractors, you know, people took me out for harvest. I sat in the front yards drinking lemonade, you know, talking with farmers. I went to lots of events, and then, you know, they have something called, you know, the Carrot Fest. It's an annual sort of, celebration that they have in the marsh. But I also spent a lot of times in archives, many, many hours in archives trying to find, you know, policy documents, sort of historical documents, newspaper articles, images, pictures. I spent time with various historical societies, just trying to sort of assemble, you know, my own story, I guess, about the marsh. And I tried to sort of put the development of the marsh within the kind of broader context of agriculture, right? So the broader sort of trends in global agriculture, and tried to show ways in which it in some ways kind of aligned with and kind of reinforced these global trends, but also ways in which there was kind of disjunctures and where the marsh sort of departed from, you know, the kind of broader trends in global kind of industrializing agriculture.
So we are going to take a short break and we will be back in just a moment.
Hearst Ranch is a proud sponsor of the Heritage Radio Network. The Hearst family has been raising cattle on the rich, sustainable native grasslands of California's Central Coast for over 150 years. Piedra Blanca Rancho in San Simeon is the original Hearst Ranch, founded by George Hearst in 1865. George's son was the famous publisher William Randolph Hearst. In addition to being known for building the iconic Hearst Castle, William was, like his father before him, an avid rancher. In his words, "I would rather spend a month at the ranch than any place in the world." Thanks to one of the largest land conservation easements in California history, a joint effort with the California Rangeland Trust, the American Land Conservancy, and the state of California, the working landscape at Hearst Ranch will be preserved forever. Learn more about Hearst Ranch at HearstRanch.com.
And we're back. This is Gastronomica on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm Jacqueline Orwell talking with Michael Klassens about his new book, From Dismal Swamp to Smiling Farms, Food, Agriculture, and Change in the Holland Marsh. So we're talking about the production of agriculture and farmland In your book, you describe, and we've chatted about this a little bit so far, but the initial transformation of the land, the valley was drained, creating fields out of wetland, and the land becomes farmable around 1935 due to a combination of efforts, engineering, policy, legislative efforts. So I have a question about infrastructure. Can you talk about how the infrastructure developed around this time, the physical infrastructure, the social and knowledge infrastructure, the new and expanding markets? So what kinds of infrastructure helped support the takeoff of this agricultural industry in the post-war period? And then how far was this produce going from Ontario? And, you know, what innovations helped it get there?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, this is, you know, this is... I mean, I think a really interesting sort of period in the Marsh. So, you know, it did take until the kind of immediate post-war period for the Marsh to really sort of take off. You know, initially, because of the nature of the soil, you know, there's this characteristic of the muck soil that makes it, you know, the nutrients are very readily available, and it's sort of custom designed in many ways to grow carrots and celery. And onions, and so initially there's this real challenge because the fields are so productive with these particular crops that local markets in Toronto are sort of glutted, and so it just drives the price down. So for you know almost a decade. There's very little farmers are making very little profit because they're growing too many of these crops. So there's a couple things here. One is that, you know, they could have tried to grow other kinds of things, right? They could have tried to just grow, you know, tomatoes or soybeans or corn or these kinds of things. But, you know, there's this notion of kind of specialization, right? That they wanted to kind of maximize the profit potential of the Marsh by growing higher value crops like celery and carrots and onions. But again, everyone was doing that, and the market was quite concentrated. And so every harvest time, you know, their prices would just be, I mean, dismal, you know, and tons of, you know, many, many, harvest seasons where crops would just be sort of plowed back in the ground because it was actually, you know, you would lose more money by bringing them into Toronto to try to sell them. So part of the reason why this was is because, you know, crops like soybeans and wheat and corn, of course, can be, you know, have been for centuries shipped around the world because they are dry crops and they don't rot, you know. Things like lettuce, you know, and at this period, they were growing a lot more lettuce in the Marsh, but things like lettuce, carrots and celery and onions, they rot quite quickly. And so you're constrained by both sort of time and space if you're growing these kinds of crops. And so in the kind of immediate post-war period, a couple of non-farmers buy up a bunch of land in the Holland Marsh. You know, they even describe themselves as businessmen first. So Philip and Morris Latchman form Federal Farms Limited in 1948, and a guy called Abram Dees founds Hardy Farms in 1954. And, you know, they bring in certain kinds of innovations that allow the food to be shipped, you know, further abroad. So a couple of really important innovations. So one was ice packing facilities. So they introduced ice packing facilities. So, you know, these very large facilities where you can bring in a bunch of lettuce, say, and very quickly, you know, basically drop a bunch of ice on it, you know.
What kind of lettuce was this at the time?
Right. So this is mostly, you know, kind of iceberg. Yeah. Iceberg lettuce. Yeah. Not the kind of fancy lettuce that we see today, of course, yeah, very right. Different, you know, because, you know, these crops at the time were also made to be, you know, there was also some like engineering on the kind of production end to make crops that were more durable so they could be shipped further and further afield. And so, yeah, I mean, these icing facilities take what's called field heat, right, out of the crop. And so it can be shipped much, you know, much sort of longer distances. So, you know, I think it was the Latchmans, if I remember correctly, made a big deal, you know, and I, you know, the other thing here is that, you know, the Holland Marsh was actually traded on the Toronto Stock Exchange. So, you know, at the time you could buy, you know, that's the other thing, that this kind of financialization, right, of the Holland Marsh. So, yeah, exactly. And so, yeah, the Lachmans, for example, make a big deal and have a big sort of, you know, public relations campaign around the fact that for the first time ever, you know, they ship Holland Marsh lettuce and celery, sorry, to England, right, to the UK. And so, you know, what this does, of course, is it expands the kind of market, right? So the market in very short order in a number of, you know, 5, 7, 10 years, goes from basically, you know, the million or so people in the Greater Toronto Area at the time to really around the world very quickly. And so what that does is it sort of reduces, you know, it expands market so that, you know, farmers have far more people, you know, to sell to. There was other innovations as well. For example, the introduction of, you know, saran wrap. Now, you know, saran wrap, of course, wasn't invented in the marsh, but it was one of the first, you know, agriculture areas in the country to start using it, you know, significantly. So this, you know, this also sort of helps preserve freshness and like expands how far you can ship and these kinds of things.
That was fascinating, as well as vacuum cooling, which you mentioned in the book. So you had mentioned, you've discussed a little bit some of the food and culinary products that come out of the marsh, or that have come out of, the, you know, that the marsh has really focused on over the last century. So lettuce is not really cultivated in the marsh these days. When did that drop off?
Yeah, so that was sort of in the 60s and 70s, I think it was. And, you know, what ends up happening is that, you know, there's a kind of increasing kind of specialization over time. And so, you know, really the area just sort of focuses in specifically on carrots and onions. So I think today that accounts for, you know, almost 70% of what's grown there. So even the kind of celery dropped off, it's only about, I don't know, 7 or 8%, I think, right now. A lot of the lettuce production ends up going to Quebec. So there are pockets of muck soil in Quebec as well. And, you know, partially this is due to, you know, how agriculture is kind of subsidized in different kinds of ways in that province. And so a lot of the, a lot of the lettuce production goes there. You know, the carrot and onion production sort of stays in the marsh. There's also, you know, the whole interesting story of the Muck Crops Research Station, which is an extension of the Ontario Agricultural College at, you know, University of Guelph. And so this is a dedicated research station that actually like is in the marsh. And, you know, they begin kind of supporting the specialization in certain kinds of ways, you know, to kind of help focus on onions and carrots. So they do all kinds of crop trials and these kinds of things, you know. They do studies on different kinds of pesticides and insecticides, different kinds of crop treatments. And this sort of helps further facilitate the kind of specialization, right? And also, you know, so they don't do genetic modification, or at least they didn't at that Muck Crops Research Station. But what they do is they will test seeds that have been sort of, you know, genetically, you know, manipulated to basically grow more durable, more sort of visually appealing crops, right? So that's how you sell more crops, is to make them durable and nice looking, you know. And I talked to one farmer and he said, you know, that he grows the ones that will sell, but he also always grows a couple of rows for himself, because he said the ones that they grow to sell are, you know, they taste, I'm not going to use the language he used probably not suitable for work language, but he basically said that those carrots, they just don't taste good.
Okay.
And so, but he does grow kind of like heirloom varieties essentially for his own personal and family consumption.
But that's interesting. So I had a question about that, but before I get there, in terms of that, the evolution of new crops, that farmers are perhaps cultivating in the region, I wanted to go back a little further. So the carrots and the celery and the onions and the lettuce, they were not the first food commodities to come out of the marsh. Is that right? I mean, this was this is where whiskey was produced in the, was that the 19th century?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So very, very early on, you know, of course they use, you know, you can cut, you know, from the marsh. Yeah. So there was a couple of earlier sort of products. So one was the marsh grasses, which were harvested. And again, you can imagine, you know, if you've ever been around a marsh, you can understand the kinds of grasses and reeds and, you know, things of that nature that are grown there. And those were cut for, you know, for mattresses, for pillows, for these kinds of things. And so there was a, you know, it wasn't a huge industry, but it was certainly, you know, that's what, you know, one of the first things that at least settlers used, used the area for. You know, the other thing was to, you know, you can cut out sort of chunks of this kind of root mat, right? And this is how you, you know, this is how you make things like whiskey, right? You roast the malt, with this peat, right? So you could pull the peat out and use that to sort of roast barley, et cetera, to make various kinds of alcohol. So there was a pretty robust, you know, according to the kind of historical documents, there was a pretty robust kind of bootlegging industry, in the marsh, during this time. So a lot of production of alcohol that was then shipped, you know, various places, in the US and Canada.
When did that subside?
So, yeah, I mean, probably, you know, when it was revealed that agriculture could bring a sort of a lot more money to the area, those sort of, you know, that sort of bootlegging activity, which was always sort of viewed as kind of nefarious and, you know, distasteful in some ways, that was quickly, you know, very quickly displaced by this more, you know, legitimate kind of activity as it was seen. You know, it was sort of, you know, agriculture, of course, was very, it was a very kind of high-minded pursuit as well, right? Particularly in this case, it was, you know, I haven't mentioned, you know, Professor William Day yet, but he was at the University of Guelph and is really the kind of the godfather of agriculture in the area. And he was a physicist and he was a thinking man. And, you know, he wanted to sort of make this landscape a sort of, you know, a kind of a factory, a kind of Fortis factory, right? That was very sort of techno, you know, it was a sort of techno landscape. He had this grand vision of making a techno landscape. So of course that was seen as a much more, just kind of legitimate use of the area than, you know, making booze.
Mm-hmm. And there's, so you note now more recently, there's a transition to mineral soil farming and greenhouse farming. As well, there is political pressure to preserve the Ontario Greenbelt, where the marsh is located, in the face of urbanization and development, even though, as you say, the muck soil will eventually be depleted. And then there's also this increased push, which you've kind of noted so far, to relocalize food systems and support local growers. So are you seeing a shift in the sustainable stewardship of these lands more recently to connect local eaters and producers through regenerative agriculture?
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, it's sort of tricky, you know, because, you know, the thing about the organic order of soil is that, again, if you can imagine that handful of material that you would pull out of a wetland, you know, it's at different stages of sort of decomposition, right? And as long as it remains underwater in kind of hypoxic conditions, that is low oxygen conditions, that material will sort of break down at a very, very slow rate. As soon as you drain the water off it and it becomes exposed to, you know, dramatically increased levels of oxygen, that breakdown process happens very, very rapidly. So, you know, so the muck soil is continually breaking down, right? It's decomposing those pieces. And then it's very susceptible to erosion, for example, right? Wind erosion, water erosion, et cetera. And so, you know, eventually, and, you know, no one knows exactly, I mean, you know, exactly how long it will be, but eventually that muck soil will just, I mean, it will be gone. Like it will just erode away, essentially, leaving, you know, just mineral soil. And already I say, you know, as I say in the book, and, you know, if you just drive around, you can see it as well on around the edges of the marsh where this layer of muck soil was always the thinnest. It's just gone in some places. So you see more greenhouses popping up and these kinds of things. So in some ways, there's nothing really to do to kind of protect the soil, you know, to protect the muck soil. You know, and I talk a bit about that as well, that, you know, the Holland Marsh is a protected agricultural area, but, you know, it's really more about protecting a certain kind of farming, not the farmland, because, you know, the farmland, again, there's nothing to really do to protect it other than, say, to, you know, to reflood it and turn it back into a wetland, which, again, given the kind of the need to kind of relocalize food systems, I don't know that that's the right, that would be the right answer. Like, I think we need to try to use this, you know, this kind of local infrastructure to support kind of food sovereignty and food security for, you know, local populations.
So the book, in the book, you offer a warning, in a sense, for farmland protection initiatives. So what lessons would you like advocates for farmland preservation and the government officials who create policy around land use to take away from your research, making this important distinction as you do between farmland and farming?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think that's just it, right? I mean, I think a lot of our farmland protection policies are actually farming protection policies. You know, the policies that protect the Holland Marsh, for example, are almost silent on the kind of this issue of subsidence, right? This issue of the soil just like inevitably kind of, you know, melting away essentially, which is a huge oversight, right? And, you know, farmland protection policies are, you know, similarly almost silent on the kinds of agriculture that are being like enacted there. You know, so for example, you know, in Southern Ontario, you know, well, I mean, all over the province, there is, you know, there is protected farmland in the greenbelt, et cetera. But what are we growing in these spaces? You know, we're not really growing food for the most part. We're growing industrial inputs. You know, we're growing soy, we're growing corn, and these aren't things that we eat. You know, we're not growing food. So I think that, you know, in order to sort of get farmland protection policy right, I think there also needs to be some provisions in terms of what's grown, you know, and that's, I mean, that's of course, a, you know, a whole other sort of kettle of fish, but, you know, we can't just say, well, we're going to protect farmland to continue growing industrial inputs for, you know, for the processing of oils, et cetera, you know? Yeah.
So the book is published by UBC Press, but it's also notable that it's open access. And this was funded through the Sustainable History Monograph Pilot and mm-hmm. the Andrew W. Mellon Foundation. Mm-hmm. Who do you want to read your book?
Well, you know, everybody, hopefully, but
right, yeah. Walk us through the decision to make it open access and.
Yeah, so this was the folks at UBC Press kind of presented me with this idea, and I thought it was a great one. You know, I mean, I think that you know, the idea of open access, of course, is such a great one. You know, and I'm very proud to be, you know, as you mentioned, I'm the president of the Canadian Association for Food Studies, and our sort of our journal, Canadian Food Studies, is open access as well, right? I mean, we sort of made that, you know, deliberate choice. And so I was very eager to, you know, to have this sort of be open source. So, you know, another reason why I wrote the book is because in Canada, in these territories, we don't really have a lot of, so I think we have a lot of like, I mean, I don't want to use the word amateur, but like sort of citizen science, you know, citizen sort of historians, citizen scientists, who have written like really compelling kind of local histories of various sort of, you know, local food systems across the country. But there's not so much scholarship on like, you know, specific kinds of growing areas, right? We don't see a lot of that. There aren't so many books or sort of, you know, academic papers sort of written about that. Partially because I think, you know, the Staples thesis was such a, you know, cast such a long shadow. And Canada was just seen as being a kind of export oriented country. And, you know, the only story to tell about it was that we grow wheat and corn and soy and we ship it to international markets. But, you know, so part of the motivation was to try to sort of, you know, problematize that proposition a bit and tell, you know, a highly localized story. So, In terms of who I'd like to read it, I mean, you know, I think that people who are interested in kind of agricultural history will find it interesting. I think people who are interested in food politics, you know, will find it interesting. You know, I think graduate students, say, who are interested in, again, the history of agriculture, or, you know, food politics, I think would find it interesting. And I think that also just you know, anyone who's sort of interested in, yeah, the kind of history of food and agriculture in this country would hopefully find the book somewhat interesting, or at least parts of it.
Absolutely. And so as we are winding up, one final question, is there anything more you'd like to add before we conclude? And where can readers learn more about your work? Do you have a website?
So, you know, I guess, I mean, one of the things that I was really trying to do with the book was to demonstrate how, you know, the kind of that, you know, foods, that food systems are inherently social as well. And that this is important for kind of how they're structured, that there's always this kind of relationship between so-called nature in society that sort of shape food systems. And so this, you know, this leads into notions of, say, food justice. So when we're thinking about sort of, again, farmland protection policy, food insecurity policy, you know, we need to hold both kind of, you know, natural kinds of ecosystems in mind, and also, you know, the kind of social implications, and that, you know, these things always need to be sort of thought of in tandem. So yeah, of course, the book is you can find that on UBC's webpage. I also have a website. It's called foodandchange.com. So foodandchange.com. I must confess that I probably don't update it as much as I should, although now that I've said that, I will absolutely update it quite quickly. and there, yeah, I mean, there you can find my, you know, my email address. You can find it at University of Toronto. It's michael.classens at utoronto.ca. I mean, be happy to, you know, if anyone wants to reach out, any potential graduate students, you know, just anyone in general, I'd be happy to chat for sure.
Thank you, Michael. Thanks for joining us today for What to Read Now with Gastronomica. We will be back in 2 weeks to feature conversations with authors from our newest issue, 22.1 Spring 2022. Join us on March 27 as we talk with Satomi Fukutomi to discuss her new article on social media and the popularization of Japanese food in Australia. For more details and further reading, visit gastronomica.org.